Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello and welcome to The Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr, and it's a true joy and a privilege to be with you here today because we get to talk about one of my favorite topics, health. So this is for anyone who has a body. Most likely that would be you listening. And this is also for anyone that really is looking for optimal performance from your own body. You have this incredible body. It has this innate ability and intelligence to heal itself. Why beat it up? Because the more it keeps having to do that healing, repairing thing, the less optimal performance you're going to get out of it. Yet then you say, why am I so tired? Why is my body not working? Why is my brain not working right? Well, it's because we need to give our bodies the chance to really do what it does best, which is grow, heal, repair. Grow, heal, repair. Maybe not in that order. How about repair, grow, heal, and then it all works together. So joining me, thank goodness, is somebody who knows a heck of a lot more about this than me, Dr. Paul Anderson. He is a doctor here in the U.S. and in Canada, pain management and sports medicine expert for over 30 years. He has developed and researched these incredible nutritional treatments for pain, sleep, weight, and brain problems. Now, anyone who set that New Year's resolution at the beginning of the month and it already fell off your radar, this conversation is for you. Anyone who's dealing with this epidemic of the flu season, this conversation is for you. Anyone who wants to release unwanted pounds, this conversation is for you. So welcome. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I am so happy you're here.
And I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. You're a local boy. I mean, San Diego, but...
Via Canada. Yes.
Right. But you get I think our station goes down to San Diego.
It does.
Yes. So tell me, first of all, longevity. It's been such a hot topic for the last, several years, decade maybe even, of longevity. What are some of the latest findings around longevity? How popular is it? What is some of the research? How possible is it?
Wow, that's seven questions in one. So We'll start off with how popular it is. It is exploding, the longevity field. How possible it is? Very possible, although genetics play probably the biggest role. So you'll be able to change somewhat of the outcome. But there's always that person that's 99 years old that smokes and drinks and cusses like a sailor, and they don't keel over. Well, that's just great genetics. But that's not like the rest of us. We have to do other things. So, yes, there's lots of things that you can do that will make a big difference in how it'll turn out.
Which is great. So tell me about your body of work, your research. It's focused on many different things, but brain is one of your main focuses, right?
And it turns out the brain, when you focus on the brain, actually affects everything else. So we can talk about longevity. We can talk about pain. We can talk about sleep. We can talk about weight. A lot of this conversation is going on in the brain. And now the latest thing is in the gut.
So the gut-brain.
Well, actually, it's the gut probiotic bacteria. We now know that we used to talk about eating right for Lisa. It's not really eating right for Lisa. It's eating right for Lisa's bugs. And it turns out your bugs can turn on your immune system, turn off your immune system. They can put you in a bad mood. They can actually relieve depression. So it turns out your probiotic bacteria are actually having a major conversation with you that most people aren't aware of.
How did you discover that? Or tell me a little bit about the science behind it.
That's been happening about the last 10 years where we've been looking at the probiotic bacteria, but then we were starting to see very strange things in the research, whereas certain strains of bacteria would cause the brain to light up, be full of serotonin. Hang on, really? That's a bit strange.
Wow.
And then, so now we're suspicious that you're actually a probiotic bacteria is driving a lot of your behavior, your food cravings, what you do, the lifestyle you're leading. A lot of it's being led by your bacteria, and it's who is in charge for the day. So if you, there's sort of the group there. There's the good guys, the bad guys, and the women. And well, we're not sure, but that whole group. They're not necessarily bad or evil, but if one gets too much control, it'll drive behaviors that you don't necessarily like.
Okay, so we have maybe the sugar craving bugs in the tummy.
Exactly.
Okay, and those are the bad ones, right?
Well, that's sort of been the misleading thing that's been going on in the press is good versus bad. You have a colony and everyone has their role. It's when one gets too large, they can be bad. So here, example, like H. pylori, which causes... potentially can cause ulcers in the stomach, but you need it. Even though it can cause inflammation, you need a small amount to actually balance the colony.
Wow.
So it's when the bad ones get too much. So yes, if you're craving sugar, that means that the ones that like sugar have overgrown, and then we'll call it inflammation. The same bacteria will actually turn on your gut immune system and then actually turn on your whole body. Inflammation system.
Interesting. So there's good flora and bad flora, but it all has to coexist, but in the right balance. And when it's out of balance...
That's when you get in trouble. Exactly.
And it's not just the stomach flu that you get in trouble with. You have all sorts of different brain imbalances, foggy thinking, that, right?
Yes, everything from depression, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, cancer. They're all now being related also to the gut.
Really?
Because we know inflammation is a big part of chronic disease states.
Right.
Inflammation is very directly affected by your gut biome. And this is the first time that science, we've noticed this. You know, 150 trillion organism, they have more DNA, your bugs on you and in you, than you actually possess.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, there for a long time, I did a lot of interviews about the source of all disease is inflammation. And that was all in the news. The source of all disease is inflammation. But then I really never got to what the inflammation was caused from, other than food sensitivities, allergies, environmental toxins, etc. I never really thought about it being related in the gut. Now, yes. You're talking about all the intestinal tract, right? The whole thing.
Most of the bacteria is in the large bowel. That's where most of it resides. There is some in the small bowel and some in the stomach. And the rest of you, but the large bowel where the main colony is, there's something called SIBO, which is small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, which can occur when you actually get too many bacteria growing in the small bowel. Basically, that's an environment mostly for digestion.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that caused from, you know, catching a virus, or is that caused from food allergies?
Yes.
Both.
Yes, it's all related. So all the things that you were talking about, toxins, exposure, you know, bad genetics, you're an undermethylator, what all these things are. At the same time, the one that's not been talked about a lot, which has gotten lost over time, is stress. Stress is one of the main problems out there when you're talking about the flu season. Stress really affects your immune system. Remember, if you're stressed, not only is it causing inflammation, cortisol is rising, growth hormones dropping, but the bowel bacteria colony is actually changing and responding. We now know it's a two-way street, and they are actually increasing your inflammation potentially.
So let's talk about this flu season, because it is showing up differently in so many different people, and I think it's related to the weakness in that person's immune system. I mean, some people have it showing up as a stomach bug. Some people have it showing up as high fevers, or it mimics rheumatoid arthritis. There's many different strains of this particular season. But does it affect you at your weakest point?
It just depends on what the pathogen is. But the problem is the population has set themselves up for this beautifully. So if you want to make a population sick and expose them to viruses and then they're going to get them, well, let's be overstressed. Okay. That lowers your immune system. Let's have poor sleep habits and not getting enough sleep at night. Going to cause a problem. Not getting enough fruits and vegetables, right? The lack of vitamins and minerals in the food supply. Not enough vitamin C. Not enough vitamin D. And then all the financial pressures and life pressures, and you put that on a population, you're going to get sick.
Perfect storm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are hospitals now with, you know, everyone wears masks. They put the flu people in the tents outside. I mean, it's like triage. And it's not going to get any better. In terms of a flu season, next season's going to be just as rocky. And why does the flu shot this year, even doctors are saying it's not working?
So we'll get some deep background on that. So when I was trained, flu shots were only for people that were immunocompromised, right? That was someone who had cancer, HIV, they didn't have a spleen. Then you get a flu shot. And that makes sense. But regular people didn't need it. Old people that were at risk of death, they get it. But you really didn't need to give it to the rest of the population because that flu shot isn't for the regular flu. This is what everyone doesn't understand. There's different types of flu. So that's for what's called pandemic flus. These are flus that go around the world, and they're quite virulent and they're quite lethal for people that are susceptible. So everyone gets a flu shot now for the flu season. Yeah, you can still get the flu. And also it changes. So that flu that's very virulent will change over the course of the year. So the vaccine may be working the first month, may not be working by the 12th month, but it wasn't designed for you in the first place. So I have no idea why regular people are getting flu shots. And I have no idea why the vaccine company is kind of giving to them and now recommending it for kids. And the latest thing is infants. Are you kidding me?
The nasal one.
Well, the thing is, your immune system should be stimulated, right? And it should be stimulated and you should be able to resist it at the best you can. It doesn't mean you're not going to get the flu, but you should be able to reduce it. But unfortunately, this whole shift, and now you're seeing what's happening is, yes, the flu shot doesn't stop all the flus. No. And your immune systems are heavily compromised. Perhaps you should be working on the compromise. And that's the conversation we should be having, not getting more vaccines.
Well, what about babies? Their immune systems are not compromised yet. They're not having, you know, financial crises and schoolwork and 401ks to deal with?
Well, first of all, in the U.S., most vaccines, anyone, 19 before the age of 24 months, and up to 24 months, they are actually under mother's protection. So a lot of those vaccines, statistically, show not really necessary that the chance of getting a side effect is higher than getting the disease it's protecting it from. The second thing is you don't need to give them at that age. You can wait. Like the MMR, which came under heavy scrutiny by Andrew Wakefield, who, by the way, has been vindicated.
Has he?
Oh, yeah. Clearly, the CDC lied. It's well documented. And I knew that before I saw the movie Vax. If you haven't seen it, recommend watch the movie Vax. Don't get too mad because that's been going on a long time. But I actually saw CDC emails that were been released saying these vaccines aren't safe. How do we lie to the public? Now, I had seen them before, and I was very suspicious. Yeah, and I had been very suspicious of the 10 so-called safe vaccine stories, and I didn't believe it. And one of the reasons I don't believe it, what's going on today is really kind of sad. So if you think about it, there's common sense has gone away. So adding mercury to a vaccine, which mercury is highly neurotoxic to a small developing brain, is that a good idea on any level?
Didn't they take that out, though?
No. It's still in.
The Marisol?
Yep, Marisol's still in, last I checked. And the point is, you don't need to be doing it. Second of all, when you get data that says, hey, it's not whether you're on a vaccine or not, that's different, but saying if you are going to do it safely. If you delayed the MMR to the 3 years, the risk of autism goes back to baseline. Wow. So why don't you do it? Well, because it becomes a conversation about money. And it should be a conversation about what's safe. These are our kids. Very sad.
Mm.
And that's what's going on.
And it goes, I mean, this whole conversation about the flu vaccine is the same thing. It's still a
neurotoxin. It's all about money.
Is it a neurotoxin? Is it still in that preservative?
No, I don't know what's in that. It's actually, it used to be egg-based. I don't know what it is now. The thing is, most people don't need it, and you shouldn't be taking it. You need to boost your own immune system, and there's lots that you can do. I'll give you tip number one.
Yes, let's talk about that.
What is your vitamin D3 level? Because the foundation of your entire body is your D3 levels. And if you haven't checked it, get it checked and make sure that it's over 60, between 60 and 100 or 120. And if it's not, that's the foundation. So that's the first thing you can do.
So vitamin D is a building block of the immune system.
It's a building block of every cell in your body has to have vitamin D. If your vitamin D is low, your immune system is low.
How much vitamin D should we have per day?
Well, that's the beauty of it. You get tested. I don't know how much I can tell you, but I can tell you having done tens of thousands of people with myself and my colleagues, the average person needs 5,000 to 10,000 IUs a day. And it sounds like, wow, that's a lot. But 10,000 is only 0.125 milligrams.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. Okay. So the number scares everybody. But that's what the average person needs.
Okay. So vitamin D. And then what about other, I mean, immune builders? What's a good, other, we know vitamin C. But
well, that's when we talk about is sleep.
Oh, yeah.
See, if you don't get, see, humans think they can store sleep. They think they're like rats. So they think they can go, I don't need sleep. I'll be nocturnal for the next 3 nights and, you know, 3 or 4 hours, but I'll make it up on the weekend. And we're not designed that way. We're designed with circadian rhythms and everything's supposed to be timed. So you need to go to bed mostly the same time at night, get up the same time in the morning. And most humans need about 8 hours. That can vary between 6 and 12. But if you're not getting that, you're not, you said at the beginning, you had to repair. You had to rebuild and you have to heal. If that's not going on at night, your immune system cannot function. So sleep's it. The next one's stress. If you're highly stressed, there's no way your immune system can be correct. There's no way you can get to an ideal weight or a healthy weight, right? That cannot happen because we know from the work from Henry Benson that if you meditated just 15 minutes a day, in 30 days you turn off 2,000 inflammatory genes.
Wow. And that's not just the, and then you end in the 3 days. You keep it going.
Yes, you keep it going. But the idea is that, so those are some things. And then some supplements. I'm a big believer in Linus Pauling, who was, you know, a hero. Then he was the goat. Then he was the hero again. So if right now I am taking liposomal C. Now, the thing about liposomal vitamin C gives you the same, almost the same blood level as IV vitamin C.
Really?
And you can take a small amount and you don't have the gut reaction.
So is it vitamin C based in fat? It's
a little micro encapsulation and it goes right through the gut. So instead of taking 4 or 6 grams, you can take a gram a day, a liposomal C. And there's different brands out there that'll work for you.
Really?
Yes.
That's
fabulous.
Amazing.
So during flu season, if you're really worried, I would be taking my that. But also at the same time, take lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. But the food supply has been compromised, even if you eat organic. So,
yes.
But I would take that liposomal C on top of that. And then I would be on oregano oil. I'd be taking 2 twice a day. Again, the same thing, oregano oil. And the final one is lots of coconut oil. Raw organic coconut oil is very antimicrobial. And so you can replace some of your fats that maybe not coming from a healthy source and using coconut oil.
Raw, you said?
raw organic. And again, good studies on all of those. There's 17 studies on organic oregano oil on how well it treats infection.
Okay, we were going to also, wow, we were also going to be talking about weight, that lovely thing. And we have this whole wonderful thing that we've heard a lot about, intermittent fasting.
Yes.
So that is a big, it's a hot topic these days, HIIT workouts, intermittent fasting, HIIT workouts, intermittent fasting. I mean, this is my world, but what is intermittent fasting and how can it really change the game in terms of the body's metabolism for weight loss?
It's interesting because this goes back 40 years. So like, you know, fitness and medicine are fashionable. So this is the new fashion that we saw 40 years ago.
You're kidding.
No, comes right back.
Just not taught in medical schools.
Oh, no. I was well educated. I had 45 minutes. And it was a very good 45 minutes, let me tell you.
Hopefully that's changed. Okay. I know my dad was an orthopedic surgeon, and I think he had one class and one nutrition class out of 13 years of medical school.
That's basically
typical.
What you have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we talk about intermittent fasting, you understand is that intermittent fasting really does great in terms of what it does for hormonal balance. So when you fast, so basically after 4 hours, body goes into a fasting state. If you do it correctly, for the first day, 2 days, you'll actually have a big increase in growth hormone and a drop in cortisol. Because we were designed is you're supposed to go out hunting. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure it makes sense that your growth hormone goes up, so you're strong, you go out hunting. But on the third day, it drops and it reverses because it thinks, well, Lisa, you're not the best hunter. Those glasses, I don't know. But so then it switches you into starvation. Cortisol rises usually on the third day. So if you're going to do an intermittent fasting, it should never be more than 2 days. And 1 day or 2 days up to you.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with intermittent fasting today, though, is to understand is the average person has 167 deadly toxins stored in their fat, according to the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And when you go into fasting, you start fat burning after 4 hours, and your maximum fat burning is at 24 hours. You're burning fat that contains these toxins, which it's unrobed, and it releases them and causes inflammation. So although we were designed for fasting, we weren't designed for toxicity. So intermittent fasting, you really need to add in some type of cleansing drink that isn't going to make you crazy with going to the bathroom, but it has to help get those toxins get into the liver, help the liver turn them from fat loving to water loving, and help gently remove them from the body.
So these fasting, by the way, could be, you know, 4 hours, 6 hours water, lots and lots of water, but it starts to change in the body, and then it releases all of this fat into the body, which is where the toxins are stored. So it really, you can, that's why people have a detox reaction to fasting, and then they stop there.
Yes, because you understand is if we hadn't tampered with the food supply, poisoned the planet, it would be great. But we did. So you have to understand is and your toxicity is ongoing. So you have to manage that part of the fast to get the best results.
Fascinating. So then once you've got that part and you start to wick away the fat from the liver in a water-soluble way, then how does it actually affect the metabolism? I know you mentioned it releases HGH and it decreases cortisol, but what does it do to your metabolism?
Well, there's a couple things. It resets the metabolism two ways. First of all, because you're not taking any calories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Metabolism
mm-hmm.
starts to be turned down,
okay.
right? It's not getting anything, right? And then it resets, and then you start eating again.
Reset. What does that mean?
It means your basic metabolic rate changes while you're fasting.
Oh,
and
so
it speeds up
faster.
Okay. Yeah, and then and when you get food back in, it starts up again. The other thing is the toxins actually dramatically affect your metabolism rate. It actually high toxin levels in the fat actually tell the body to slow down your metabolism and to create more fat.
Why?
Because when you get a toxin in your body has intelligence. What are you going to do with it?
Buffer it.
Yeah. So the only organ that'll take it is the fat. And fat's really mean. So it says, I'll take it, but I'm going to make more fat. I'm going to inflame everybody, and I'm going to turn your metabolism down. Oh, thank you. That's very kind. So when these toxins are coming out, remember, they're going to circulate. They're going to inflame your body. They're going to get sucked back into your fat that's remaining, right? So part of that is reset your metabolism. So when you come back in, your basal metabolic rate is better than when you started, right? Because it's gone through this change over the fast. Second thing is you got to get those toxins and get them out.
So that's – you just explained that. So I'll do a day and a half cleanse where I'll do a full day and then half the next day. And then I notice that I continue to drop weight in day 3 and 4, and that's why, because my metabolism doesn't teach me how to talk though. But it speeds up, and then it actually is more efficient with the foods that I eat afterwards, provide they're clean foods.
You understand, as soon as you spike growth hormone, your metabolism changes entirely.
Huh.
Because growth hormone is building muscle and burning fat. Cortisol, you gain fat and you burn muscle. So if you just think about it, first of all, muscle burns more energy. Second of all, building muscle takes a lot more energy than storing fat. So that hormonal shift that goes on, and it will persist. So again, if you want to do intermittent fasting, you got to do something for the cleansing for the toxins. But also when you finish, what you want to start to do is do all those other activities that boost growth hormone. And you mentioned HIT training.
Mm-hmm.
High intensity training does the same thing. So when you combine the two, what you're trying to do is getting to the state we call positive anabolic balance, which means my growth hormone's high, cortisol's low, which means inflammation is low. If I can get into that state, that means I'm always gaining a little muscle. So I'm building muscle and burning fat 24/7.
So cool. So there's a whole lecture that Dr. Paul is doing tomorrow night, Thursday night, and he is it's in Agora. And if you go to the website, which is theawareshow.com/nutrition, it's theawareshow.com/nutrition, you'll find that it's tomorrow night. It's at the Agora Community Center in Agora. It's 7 to 9. And Dr. Paul Anderson's going to be speaking on this and many, many more things about nutritional cleansing, about longevity, about a little bit about medical myths that we're going to get into a little bit. And it's very good for athletes, especially if anyone's into wanting to find out how to find your peak performance, get stronger, get leaner, get faster, be able to train longer, recover easier. And it really is great for maximizing your performance. So even if you are not an athlete and you're really looking to change and transform your body, this is also going to help you. But it's a conversation pretty much for peak performance. And so even athletes train, cleanse. Even athletes?
Well, a lot of athletes won't cleanse because they're worried about lean muscle mass loss, which is understandable. But the better athletes have learned that intermittent fasting and cleansing really works well. Now, most athletes are training at least 6 days a week. So the most they can cleanse or intermittent fast and cleanse is on the seventh day.
One day. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in season they're training 7 days a week. They can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So depending on who
matter.
They're – yeah.
Okay. And then let's get into the conversation if we can about protein and the importance of protein in metabolic function. Good one, huh? It's a big topic.
I'm not sure what you mean by metabolic function.
Oh, in fat burning.
Oh, in fat burning.
Yeah.
So to give you an example – they took a group of obese women and they added a whey protein complex shake and they all lost weight in 30 days.
Without exercise?
They didn't change anything. All they did was they added additional protein.
Oh, they added protein. Mm-hmm.
Whey protein complex, if you can do dairy, is actually shown to be quite anabolic. It raises growth hormone.
Okay. So I'm just noticing that if you go to theawareshow.com, you will be able to listen to Dr. Paul's interview and the description and so forth for the event will also be on there, which were – thank you so much, Joyce. All right. So if somebody increased – if they added a simple whey protein to their diet –
that's what it was shown. But again, you got to get enough protein throughout the day and you have to get the right kind of proteins. Some are more anabolic than others, and are they complete proteins? So some of the vegetarian proteins out there are not complete. Humans need complete protein to build muscle, which is in other tissue. So we need to have complete protein.
Okay, question. So if the complete protein consists of the amino acids, right?
Yes.
The building blocks that really – what do they do?
You're asking me basic about – okay. Yeah. So basically, when you synthesize things in the body, they use those amino acids to build bone, to build muscle, to build tissue, skin, brain, so on.
Okay. So those amino acids is what causes the body to – it creates a chain reaction in order to go into the fat burning mode or to use the fat to create the lean muscle mass?
What the protein does – is it's muscle sparing. So think if you didn't have any protein for a week, what would happen was the body would start to scourge and look for amino acids, right? Because it's got to be repairing. So it's going to actually pull those and it'll actually burn it as fuel too when you're really starving. When you're not starving, you want to take those amino acids, you want to use it to build tissue. And if you're under protein every day, you're never going to be able to build that muscle mass and you'll actually start to decrease. So over the age of 40, the average person loses half a pound of muscle a year. That's a lot. So if you think 20 years later, you've lost a lot of lean muscle mass. The second problem is low-calorie diets. So you're going to starve yourself. Pennington looked at this in UCLA, but on average, one-third of the weight loss is muscle and bone. So every time someone goes on a low-calorie diet, even if they weigh the same, they're one-third fatter.
Wow.
So the more you diet, the fatter you are, even though you may weigh the same because you're dieting off your lean muscle mass and bone. So what you're asking about is if you start putting protein and amino acids into your diet correctly, what will happen is you'll start to increase that muscle mass. But you've got to start training. You can do it without, but also you really need to be in the gym.
Okay. So it's got to go hand in hand. Now, what does this have to do with osteoporosis? Could those amino acids help with not having bone loss?
To some extent, but osteoporosis is typically a couple of things are going on. That's when we talk about alkaline versus non-alkaline water.
Mm.
Everyone talks about the alkalinity. It's not the alkalinity. It's if you have high pH in water, for example, you will buffer that by taking calcium out of your bones.
Really?
So it'll demineralize the bones. If you have high cortisol levels, if you're highly inflamed, you're not sleeping well, you're highly stressed, again, cortisol high is going to demineralize the bones. So all the things we talked about earlier are important, but also weight bearing. Weight bearing exercise and being on your feet. So instead of being at a seated desk, the biggest tip is to be at a standing desk. That will do more, and doing weight bearing exercise.
Okay. And so that is for everyone. And then if you were if you're an athlete and if you go to this, to the lecture tomorrow night, is it more protein if you're an extreme athlete, or not even an extreme, just an athlete? Do you want to do a certain amount of grams per day? Is it different for males and females? Can you talk a little bit about that? How much protein?
Yes, to all of those that you said.
Okay.
So it turns out, what are you trying to do? If you're trying to build muscle, you need to take in more protein. If you're maintaining your body, you take in less protein. If you're older, you need less protein because your liver and kidneys are not as effective.
Mm.
So it depends how anabolic are you, how much lean muscle mass are you trying to put on, and that determines how much you should take. Men and women are different, yes. So there's averages given, so women are 60 to 80. Men are about 100 to 150 grams. But it really depends on how anabolic you are. You can take a lot more if you're training harder. Again, you have to be mindful that the liver and the kidneys do have limits. So, yes,
okay.
So you are entirely correct.
So it's interesting. So if you increase the protein, then it converts into lean muscle mass, and then the muscle burns fat.
Yes.
And it also requires the
make sure we're training in the middle of that, yes.
Okay, yes. Make sure that you're training in the middle of that. Okay. All right. So in terms – okay, this is some of the – new science around some of the best types of diets and exercise out there. And it's not one diet fits all. It's a lifestyle, right? It's not like you can go on the pineapple diet, lose a bunch of weight, and then return back to your normal eating patterns and keep it off. This is something that you have to continually keep going with.
Right. And it's interesting because what's happened now is we used to say, you know, highly refined carbs were bad. Any of them were bad for Lisa. I don't care which one I gave her. And there's some new work being done out of Israel. This was published. Aaron Siegel and his group. And what they've shown was it's not true. It's actually your probiotic bacteria generally determine what happens when that carb hits you, whether you're going to actually get a blood sugar spike along with some insulin release or not. So I'll give you an example. You and I go to the ice cream shop. You have ice cream. I have ice cream. Your blood sugar is dead normal. Mine's spiking and my insulin's going crazy. And then we decide we're going to have some tuna rolls the next day. So we have rice. Well, I'm fine. You're a mess. And it turns out that the DNA of your probiotic bacteria are a better predictor of how your body does in terms of foods it needs. So we also say it used to be eat right for Lisa. Well, Lisa's very important. But it turns out her bacteria, they're more important.
More important.
And so feeding your bugs turns out is what's best for you. And so they've actually started a company that's just starting down this road, really the first commercially available DNA typing.
Testing. Mm-hmm.
And they will predict what foods that would work well for you. And we just started a research project with a friend of mine. I'm looking at this, and we're looking at what food would cause your bacteria to put you into a better fat-burning state.
Wow.
Hmm.
Fascinating. I mean, I'm not a big fan of ice cream, I hate to say, but I'm not. And probably that's also my body telling me, go for a tuna roll.
Exactly.
Which it likes better. That's funny. But, no matter what, it's individualized for each body.
Oh, very much so.
Cool.
And then we have different food reactions. We've done studies with people on food reactions. There was no rhyme or reason. We had every food on the planet, and yours might have 10, John might have 2, and I might have 32, and
right.
They're not related. And then what fuels you well and fuels me well will be entirely different. So it's like you said, you know, your body intelligence, yeah, that doesn't make me feel good.
Yeah. I'm gluten-free specifically, but my poor husband is fine with gluten, and he never gets it. Sorry. Sorry, honey. All right. So that's the wonderful chimes going off in my life. All right. So we've talked – let's talk a little bit about some medical myths and some controversy. Cholesterol, does it cause heart disease?
No.
But it's – everybody says it does. The medical
– Well, the first thing is when everyone tells you things like that, my radar goes up because usually it's wrong. But second of all, I'm just going to phrase this as a question.
Okay.
When we have a scientific theory – right? We have a theory, and then we do observation, and then we have data. The data has to match the theory. You can't have the data really wrong and have the theory. So I'll give you some data. And this is how the conversation goes. Half the people that have normal cholesterol have heart attacks. Well, if your theory is that high cholesterol causes heart attacks, why do half of them have normal? Now, if I did any other scientific theory in the planet, I have a theory of gravity. Half the time I throw things up, they don't come back. That's not a theory of gravity. Right? So, like, just scientifically, it's so absurd. Like, I don't even know where to go from that. But here's the second part. When you look at population studies, so we look at the Finns and we look at the French, they have identical cholesterol levels, highest on the planet, those two countries. Finns have the highest heart attack rate. The French are one-third below every other industrial country. Now, one would ask is, well, how come the Finns are keeling over and the French are partying like rock stars and they're fine? Mm-hmm. And when you look around the planet, it turns out if you look at the heart disease rate, whether the cholesterol is high or low, you can't predict because it's all over the map. And so what you've had is you've had this model that's been based on a myth. So we ask to say, okay, and then your other theory is cholesterol is just rolling around and suddenly decides to leap out of my leap onto my coronary arteries. Why? Well, that's now becoming an interesting question. It means your arteries are inflamed. Why are my arteries inflamed? Well, that's becoming a very interesting question. And actually this year, although I'm not a pharmaceutical guy, the first anti-inflammatory heart disease drug is going to be released. I believe it's this year. And they said it's 10 times more effective than statins. Yes, because they're treating inflammation. And it turns out cholesterol has a secondary role. If there's any inflamed artery or vein, it's like a bicycle tire patch. And it comes along because it's worried that you're going to blow a hole. So we vilify the one thing that's doing, because it's inflamed, it jumps on there and there's all these changes.
Isn't there good and bad cholesterol though?
No. All cholesterol is good, which is absurd. So the body design, so it's all been about positioning. Think about it. Why can we have bad cholesterol and good cholesterol? Well, that makes no sense. It's actually different types of cholesterol. The one that's been vilified is the one that's been leaping on the artery, but it's leaping on the artery because you're highly inflamed. Now, I always say, don't take my word for it. Go read The Great Cholesterol Myth by Dr. Steven Sinatra, and then you decide. And everyone who's read the book has been horrified because when they actually read the real data, it doesn't support the model.
Interesting. Wow. All right. So can we talk a little bit about autoimmune disease and why is it so on the rise? Is it just because it's more reported now and discovered and being diagnosed? Has it been underdiagnosed for a long time? Or is it truly increasing in the population?
I think it's increasing a lot in the population.
Why?
Autoimmune disease is usually a combination of several things. One is genetics. Some people are just more susceptible to their immune system. Second of all, those leaky gut. Leaky gut's a major problem because once things that are supposed to be digested and broken up, but they actually come in as a whole piece, can actually cross over and your body gets mixed up. I'm getting a whole piece of tomato. I actually think that's part of my knee cartilage. Uh-oh. Right? So that's a big problem. Toxins are another problem, right? So the immune systems are already heavily compromised. And then we're eating things that are genetically modified and all those things start to have an influence. And it's usually a perfect storm where there's a virus maybe involved and actually the immune system just gets crossed over. And then once that happens, you're in big trouble.
And there's kind of there's a point where you're not supposed to be able to reverse it, but people have. Or they've at least reversed the symptoms.
Certainly you can reset it. I mean, there was an Italian researcher I've been following for 25 years and treating autoimmune disease consistently. And the first thing he does is he fixes the leaky gut. He turns down the inflammation with natural supplements. And then finally, he actually gets them moving and exercising, meditating, doing all the sort of things we talked about. And they actually, a lot of them recover. And I've treated some of them in my pain world. We all the time get the autoimmune. Done very well.
So speaking with, by the way, my guest is Dr. Paul Anderson. And we're talking about, he is a pain specialist. Let's talk about pain for a second. If many people are in a state of chronic pain, and it could be through accidents or injuries and so forth, is there a way or how do you turn that down? I mean, that's a big question, I know. But when people experience pain from accidents and injuries, is there a way to turn down the pain centers in the brain
using
nutrition?
There's nutrition is one of them, but the best way by far that we've used for chronic pain was work from Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn in the 80s. And he had people meditating an hour a day, 65% in improvement in pain levels in 4 weeks. And we actually did that in our clinic. The second one is sleep. If you can get someone who has chronic pain to sleep for two good nights, that actually about 50% of their pain would go away.
Wow.
And after that, we have to use more sophisticated strategies. Nutritional supplements by themselves are not usually enough, but invariably they'll have food reactions. They'll have a leaky gut. You've got to turn down the irritation from wherever the part is broken. And then the brain, you got to go to work on. And we've used entrainment, and we use cranial electrical stimulation, and both have been highly effective.
So most people are prescribed opioids for pain, and we have this opioid epidemic now that is crossing into all sorts of different generations. What does the opioid do in long term? Like, first of all, what does it do? How does it reduce pain?
It mimics your natural opioids is what it does. So we already have those pathways. So it ties in. So it's, your endorphins are your natural opiates. So unfortunately, some of them need it, and they're getting kind of washed in the way in the addiction. So most true chronic pain patients, usually under 20%, are actually addicts, and some of them also have pain, which is a real problem. Mm-hmm. The other 80% actually really have pain. But as a primary treatment for chronic pain, opioids are not the first choice. All those other things we would do. You use multiple treatments at the same time to break the pain cycle, get them back, and get them moving. If we get them moving and exercising a little bit, big changes. But some of them still need a little bit of opioid. What's happened now, though, is the addicts have switched. So we had the cocaine addicts in the 80s, then we had heroin in the 90s. Now we have the opioid addicts. So there's the addiction world, and there's people with chronic pain, and they're different. The addicts, there's a different reason they've chosen that. But one of the problems is fentanyl. Fentanyl is so powerful that basically an amount the size of your fingernail will kill you, pure fentanyl. So that means that the drug dealers and so on can bring in tiny amounts and cut them and still provide the high and the addiction that the addicts are looking for. That's part of the problem.
So it's all about that endorphin release, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And which you can do in so many other ways.
Yeah, there. Again, you know, if you look at addiction from a way that it's basically a dysfunctional brain, and so instead of having a broken arm, and it's obvious, the brain's not happy, and they'll pick things to try and balance their brain chemistry. So it's the same with pain, right? You're lacking endorphins. Chronic pain patients have very low endorphin levels.
Mm-hmm. Are many people moving towards those types of opioids because their brains are already predisposed for depression and not producing enough endorphins and not producing enough serotonin?
It can be depression. It can be that they actually were a pain patient and their endorphins dropped, so then they got addicted. It can be a lot of ways, but basically the brain is unhappy. And
that's an epidemic, though, unhappy brains.
Well, I mean, if you're gonna do the, you're doing all the things that don't work well for humans, right? We were designed to move, designed to be out in the sun, designed to have, you know, healthy food supply, no toxins, sleep well. Low chronic stress, and we don't do any of that.
And things that make us happy, like families or exercise or travel and all those things, but it's those become leaner and leaner too as our world gets more and more complicated. So it's really more of a lifestyle epidemic than it is a brain chemistry problem.
Well, one's leading to the other, yes.
Hmm.
Yes. And then new thing we've sort of been looking at so the last decade is undermethylation is a big problem.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about methylation. What is it?
So methylation is basically adding a chemical group to different compounds throughout the body to function. So whether that's protein or neurotransmitters or your brain chemicals, detox, all need this methyl group. And the way it travels is folate's supposed to take your little methyl group and hand it off to B12. And you're supposed to have methylated B12. Well, a third of the population, folate can't handshake with the methyl, doesn't get onto the B12, then you're screwed. I mean, there's no other to say it because basically you can't detox. Every system goes down, but particularly the brain. You can't make your serotonin. You can't make endorphins. You can't make dopamine.
Is there just one pathway for that or are there many?
Nope. You got to go through this one pathway.
Wow.
If you're not methylating, you can't make all those things properly. Now, there's different degrees of your under methylation problem. But if it's two main genes, but if you're homozygote deficient, which means both of them are bad, those people really run into a lot of brain chemistry problems.
So how can you increase methylation?
In terms of methylation, what we've been doing is basically supplementing. So it will supplement like methylated B12 or methylated folate. And you have to – you need a lot of experience. Not sure who needs what. But an interesting story is some populations are all under methylators, and they actually have bacteria that produce methylated B12 for them.
Interesting.
And they get sick when they come here. So if you take them out of the little village in Sri Lanka, they come here, they take some antibiotics, bacteria in their gut changes. Next thing you know, they're not making methylated B12. They're depressed. They're having heart attacks, right? Whatever it is, because they were protected in their village. They came here and we messed with their biome.
Vice versa, if we go to the village, then we get attacked by the bacteria because we don't have that natural methylation process to protect us. I know we're jumping all over the place, and this is so interesting that you know so much about so many things. It's hard to pick one topic and stick with it. But can we talk about antibiotics, first of all, you mentioned. When you take one round of antibiotics, does it destroy the gut flora permanently, or will it regrow itself naturally, or do you have to help it?
You have to help it, unfortunately. Okay. And then, you know, there's antibiotic supply in city water if you're drinking city water. And if you're not eating organic meat, it's in the meat supply.
Pesticides, right?
Right. So you really have to repopulate. So there's two biome populations. One is residual, which is about 80%, and 20% changes over every day. But your residual, you really want to make sure that colony is repopulated. Right now, the challenge we're having is everyone's colony is quite individualized, so it's hard to give general advice.
Interesting. That makes a lot of sense. And then I was going to ask you about B12, but real quick, I just wanted to let everyone know that Dr. Paul Anderson is going to be speaking tomorrow night, January 25th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Agora Hills Community Center in Agora Hills. It is right off the 101, and I think it's the exit is Lost Hills, and 7 to 9 tomorrow night. And the topic is the new exercise science on the 7 best ways to a stronger, leaner, faster you. And this specifically is for athletes, anyone who wants to be an athlete, anyone who's interested in peak performance, weight loss, and muscle recovery, and how that aids in maximizing your performance. Now, you can find out about this. You can get the details a couple different ways. If you go to theawareshow.com/nutrition, you'll see a webpage there, or you can just email nutrition@theawareshow.com. If you have questions, that's email nutrition@theawareshow.com. You can also listen to this interview again if you go to our website, which is theawareshow.com, and you will be able to see Dr. Paul's interview here on the main page, and the description and the proper link is also there. If all else fails, just go to theawareshow.com and you'll see everything right there. But we'd love to see you tomorrow night. I'm going to be there with my husband, and we're going to be talking as well and hosting the night. Dr. Paul, of course, is going to be there with all this great information, slides to enhance his topics, and so it's all good brain stuff. Okay, Bs, B12, B folic acids, all those great things. Is a B complex is like a one size fits all, or do you really need to be more specific on your?
Yes, you need to be more specific. Yes, and also you need to know if you're a methylator or an undermethylator.
How do you find that out?
There's you can get tested. The big thing right now, everyone's using 23andMe, but it doesn't actually give you complete data. You actually have to take it to another piece of software because the government wasn't liking what they were saying, so you now have to bring it to an interpreter. But you really need to get your methylation status tested to know, and some people are just taking the methylated vitamins to avoid the whole discussion.
Interesting. I wonder if Ancestry.com does the same thing.
I'm not sure about that. I just know about
the 23andMe.
Most of them are using 23andMe.
Okay, good to know. So so you said that we have, yes, low sleep, stress, all sorts of things going on in our body. And the right diet and exercise, of course, helps, but do we need to increase our level of B vitamins because of the added stress in our lives and in our world and our environmental toxins? Is it all really about that, the Bs?
It's not the only thing, no.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about you. How much do you need? So I'll give you an example. So when we were treating she takes 5,000 micrograms of methylated B12. But we check her blood levels, and that, the reason that was done was because she's a serious undermethylator.
Mm.
And that actually got her into a normal level. But there's some people that have too much Bs. It depends. If you're an undermethylator, you're actually your B12 levels will be high because it's not moving on into the pathways. So, again, the big thing is if you're going to do this, get checked and see where you are and then supplement from there.
Okay. Okay, so that's good advice. Now, if anyone has any questions also, you can call us here, 818-985-KPFK. We're also Facebook Live-ing this right now, and we're streaming on theawareshow.com. I mean, The Aware Show's Facebook page, so you can see us in studio. I probably should have mentioned that like an hour ago. Sorry. But go say hi to us there. My husband's in studio, and he's our social media chairperson today. So anyway, you can give us a call here, 818-985-KPFK, and I'll get to the phone in just a second. So have we covered this? What are we haven't even talked about arthritis and the relationship between arthritis and leaky gut. Is there one?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, it's the same sort of thing we talked about earlier, is that when you have food particles that are getting in and they're coming into the body, and the immune system reacts, sometimes it crosses over and starts to attack the cartilage. Sometimes that turns into autoimmune. Sometimes that's part of the arthritic process. Now, the arthritic process is sometimes, when we're talking about osteoarthritis, is a traumatic event. What's interesting, though, is in most osteoarthritis, you find strains of bacteria that are similar to TB. So that mycobacteria, is that a cause? Is that incidental? We don't know yet. But there's definitely more in this process going on that we don't know.
Wow. So it goes back to individual testing or back to the gut flora conversation we were having earlier?
We're definitely going to end up having a gut flora because we know it will reduce inflammation.
Okay, cool. Let's see here. We've got phone calls coming in. Jack in La Mesa. Jack, do you have a question for Dr. Paul Anderson? Hi, Jack.
Earlier that organics are tainted. I wanted to know what he meant by that.
Organic food tainted? I don't know if
I don't think so. I'm an organic food eater, so
yeah.
I would say
that's okay.
Yeah.
Kind of freaked me out, but yeah, that's what I heard. But
I'm glad. No, that would freak me out too.
Strong organic because it has less pesticides, fungicides, insecticides. So I'm a big organic believer.
All right, keep on eating organic, Jack.
Doctor, well, you got a lot of good information there, and I really appreciate what you're doing today.
Thank you, Jack. Thanks, Jack.
Okay, take care.
You too. All right, let's go to Ellen in Huntington Beach. Hey, Ellen, do you have a question for Dr. Paul Anderson?
Well, I've been prescribed. I'm taking like 8 prescribed medications, and I just don't know what to do.
Yeah, you want to know how to wean yourself off of them.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I take a bunch of supplements, but I don't know if they're helping. And I'm diabetic, and I'm just.
Okay,
I'm
glad that you called, Ellen, and I'm really glad that you lasted this long in this hour and you got to hear this. And sounds like you're having a breakthrough, which is great news. And as we've always talked about, breakdowns lead to breakthroughs. Ellen, please don't judge yourself. You have a wonderful amount of education and awareness that is at your fingertips to even start. Dr. Paul, can she start with the probiotics during this process of being on the medications and talking to her doctor about how to wean herself off of them?
Absolutely. And when you're taking that much medication supplements, you need to find someone that you know and you trust and go in with that list, right, and have them go through because I'm telling you, taking that much, there's probably something conflicting and you need to get that sorted out.
But it's possible, Ellen, and people have done it, and they have weaned themselves off of various medications through diet and exercise, and it's not it's actually pretty – once you get started and once you start moving the body, then your body starts to produce serotonin, and the serotonin helps you come up with new ideas. And it's amazing how the brain chemistry works. All you have to do is just start moving your body slightly, stimulate that neurotransmitter, that brain chemical, that happy chemical, and it helps you come up with motivation. It's the motivating chemical of the brain. It is the happy chemical of the brain. So get moving, girlfriend, and know that you can change. Okay, honey?
Okay, but I just don't, all of my doctors seem to be set on their pills, and I don't know who to go to.
Right. Well, you know your own truth. And then, and once I said, if you actually can start to come up with a little bit more empowerment within yourself, then you can start to give direction to what it is that you want and believe that it's possible. And that's where all change really starts, is with you. All right. Thank you so
okay.
much for your call. All right.
Thank you.
Lots of people that in that similar situation. I'm glad that she called. And for our Facebook listeners, that was a listener that called and said she's on 8 different medications and she's getting counterindications and she was crying and in a very difficult place about that. And I get that. When you get sucked into the system, you lose your personal information because you put your life in the hands of people that you think know better than you. I'm a big proponent of co-teaming with your doctor. It's your body ultimately. And if you do research and you bring it to your doctor, then you can work with your doctor. This is what the whole point of integrative medicine is. And it's about this whole age that we're in now is about people empowerment. With as crazy as our world is getting and as ridiculous as our government is, we need to get back into the power in the hands of the people. So that's how we make true change. So just soapboxing here for a second, but I know that you agree with me. All right. Well, we just have a minute. Thank you so much for being here and for coming in studio. And thank you to all of our Facebook listeners and viewers there. And you can go to theawareshow.com. You can hear this interview again. You can check out Dr. Paul's interview. Joyce will upload it as soon as we are done here. And then if you want to go to the link about tomorrow night's talk, it's tomorrow night. January 25th, 7 to 9 at the Agora Hills Community Center. I will be there to say hi to you all, and you can check that out at theawareshow.com and also go to theawareshow.com/nutrition or nutrition@theawareshow.com. Thank you so much. Thank you, Joyce Walker and Kiana. Thank you so much for engineering today, and to Gina Salvati, executive producer of The Aware Show, my wonderful husband, John Davis, and thank you so much, Paul Anderson. And mostly thank you for listening. It's your energy and your exchange that makes this show possible. I'm Lisa Garr. Until next time, I invite you to stay aware.